You are a human animal. You are a very special breed. For you are the only animal who can think, who can reason, who can read.
Hello, and welcome to Bookworm. I'm Michael Silverblatt. Today's show is part of a series entitled Imaging the Us, an exploration of autobiographical writing, which is a collaboration between Bookworm and the Getty Center for the History of Art and the Humanities. This collaboration looks at the relationship between autobiographical writings, memory, and the articulation of an us. My guest today is Quincy Troupe, an American poet who lives in La Jolla. He's the author of 5 books of poetry, most recently one called Weather Report from Harlem River Press. A new collection, Avalanche, will be coming out from Coffee House Press in 1996. He has the unusual distinction as well of being the co-author of the autobiography of Miles Davis. Quincy, I wanted to begin by asking you, because your father was the second most famous catcher in the Negro Leagues and you've been writing about him, what is the first thing you remember about your father?
The first thing I remember about my father is something that I put in this memoir, is that we were coming around, and I grew up in St. Louis, Missouri, and my father came by, he had bought a new little car, and he took my brother and I out for a ride. And it was a great ride out into the countryside of St. Louis. And then when we came back, I remember coming down Eastern Avenue, which has now been renamed Martin Luther King. And I had been asleep for about maybe a mile or so. I'd kind of fallen asleep. I guess I'd been lulled by the countryside and the riding of the wheels. And we turned the corner to move into this little kind of little place where we lived. And I thought we were there. And I opened the door of the car and fell out and hit my head and knocked myself unconscious. And I remember when I woke up about maybe 5 or 6 hours later, my father's face was over my face, and he had all this concern and tears and everything. He was kind of crying when he saw me wake up. And it's funny because my mother always tells people, you know, my son is a little touched since that day he fell out of the car. You know? So that was my first memory of him.
So your first memory of your father, this is interesting, comes from the unconscious, comes from awaking from unconsciousness.
Waking up.
Can you tell me, you were born in St. Louis, and that, I gather, your family was very involved with the music scene there. Was that a household thing, or was that just a St. Louis thing?
Well, it was my brother was turned out to be a great drummer, jazz drummer, rhythm and blues, and then jazz drummer. And then my cousin Marvin was a great drummer. And for a while there, my brother was the greatest jazz drummer to come out of St. Louis for a while until he stopped and went into the ministry. But, you know, all my friends, John Hicks, Lester Bowie, Julius Hemphill, who I became friends with later and who just died, Oliver Lake, and all of these great musicians, I kind of knew them. I was a little younger than them, but I knew them growing up because they would come over to the house and play with my brother and play with my stepfather. After my father divorced, my mother divorced my father, was a blues bass player. And so he was the house band at the Riviera in St. Louis, Missouri. And so he used to be the house band for Howlin' Wolf. You know, he came to town, Howlin' Wolf, Lightning Hopkins, Muddy Waters, Bo Diddley. He would back all these groups. And so they used to all be over their house. They'd all be over their house and smoking cigarettes and cigars and drinking whiskey and talking and telling lies, or as was said last night, versioning. And so I grew up around all of that sort of atmosphere, as well as, before that, baseball players, Satchel Paige, Monty Irving, all these people coming to the house who were really like the blues players, in a sense. I kind of grew up in that kind of atmosphere. My house was always alive and animated with language and people and music and food and celebration, it seemed like. You know, it wasn't a dull place.
Because my sense of your work in relation to autobiography is that, unlike other writers who have a stock of specific memories they want to write about and conditions that they're trying to describe, yours is very much a kind of patchwork of sounds and impressions and incantations that really do seem to come almost
from what the mind receives when it is otherwise unconscious. It's almost as if this work is an attempt to replicate in sound the noise and tumult of the world around you.
Yes, that's true. I it was funny. I was telling my class where I teach at the University of California, San Diego, my experimental writing class. We were reading, discussing Autumn of the Patriarch by Gabriel Garcia Marquez. And they were like astounded by this book because it's six chapters, six paragraphs, and you know, with these long, you know, monologues and pages after pages of sentences. And they were just, and I said to them, you know, the world is like that. The world is just like that. The world is it's a rush. And the attempt to put structure on everything sometimes is interesting, but it does not mirror the way the world is, for example, in a sense. And so mine is to try to recapture all of that I lived through and grew up in and still live through.
So would you say that for you, memory, autobiography is a record of the flux of the senses?
Yes. That, and it's a memory of the record of the flux, but it's also specificity, you know, that I remember the details, certain kinds of details that kind of, I think, make that live in another way. So I want to get the rhythm and the flow of all of that, but I want to get the details also up in it. You know what I mean? I want to get some of the details and the language and all of that up in it, because we live in a flow. That's what we live in. We live in a flow. It is, you know, we live with the unexpected right around the corner all the time. We can't always tell what's going to happen.
See if this resonates for you, because what I find in your work, it's as if a specific is like a pebble, and then the poem is all of the ripples and improvisations that come up as a result of casting that pebble.
That's very good. That's good. That's really good. It is. That's what it is. Because we live in that kind of context. We live in a context, and we're here, and all of these things are happening around us. And what I'm trying to do, especially in my poetry, but also in the autobiography and that kind of writing, is to evoke all of these other things that are happening around us. You know, we're here, but all of these other things are happening around us. And that's sometimes people, I've been, some critics have said, Quincy Troupe hits you with a barrage of images and metaphors. And it's true, because those are the things that are around us, these various metaphors and images.
Well, I wanted to speak about your autobiographical practice. And the first thing that strikes one in the poems is that instead of saying the pronoun I, mm-hmm. this is virtually always and from the beginning replaced by a lowercase e, E-Y-E, I, as if the self had been subtracted and vision itself were being put in its place.
Yes, that's also exactly true. That's good. And also, you know, I read someplace a long time ago, and I only use that in poetry, that lowercase E-Y-E, and it is to see the third eye here, you know, in the forehead. It's about that, too. It's about seeing. It's, you know, so I liked your description of that.
But I get the sense that unlike other memoirists and people who write confessional poems, that you don't see the self as being necessarily important.
I think that the self is important to me, you know, to me. I think it's important to myself, that I keep myself healthy, that I keep myself stable, that I think well, that I do that. That's important to my family, to my wife, and all of that. I'm like Toni Morrison, and she says, you know, my life is very boring. You know, my life is very boring. You know, I mean, because I write all the time, I work all the time, and what I think is important is the imagination. The imagination of the self, the imagination of the person, what the person sees in the imagination. I live in the imagination. And so what I do every day, for the most part, is uneventful. You know, I teach. I go to my study and I write, and I go with my students and I with my son and my wife and, you know, with my good friends. We eat dinner. We go, you know, go and have good times. But that's, you know, that's uninteresting for me in terms of literature. And so for me, the mind, the place of the imagination, what I can imagine, what I can dream about, what I can, you know, imagine. That's what I like to write about.
Exactly. You know, it seems to me you've once said that the form of Ralph Ellison's The Invisible Man is the form of an autobiography. Mm-hmm. But it seems to me that you've got in your writing a generation after The Invisible Man. What happens then if the invisible man disappears and all you've got is this eye, mm-hmm. and the eye is going to render not the outer life, but the inner life, mm-hmm. the flux of consciousness? Mm-hmm. It seems to me then that it's only a hop, skip, and jump to the sound of Miles Davis, where what you hear in terms of sound is primal, an oral report of the inner state.
Yes, I think that sound is memory. I think that sound evokes memory. I'll tell you a little anecdote. When I went to Africa and spent a year teaching there at the University of Ghana and then the University of Lagos in Nigeria, and I went out to the fields. I was going out to the fields to kind of listen to the peasants in the field to see. And I heard the same sounds that I heard in Mississippi and Tennessee and African-American field workers, you know. I heard the same kind of tone, same kind of sound, the same kind of rhythm. And it was very interesting to me, you know, to hear that, because I'd been hearing it all my life. I'd been hearing it in the fields in Louisiana when I went to college, and when I would go visit my relatives, and I'd heard it in the church. I heard it in the blues singers, that kind of tone. And then here I am in the fields listening to the same thing. And then I heard it in the clubs, you know. So that sound is memory. That sound is memory. And so the preservation of that, I'm interested in the preservation of that sound, but I'm also interested in the preservation of the sound of America, because I've lived here with Europeans, with Native American Indians, with Asians, and so we come to a place now where that fusion of sound is what I'm really, really, really interested. I'm interested in that sound, that my ancestral sound, but I'm also interested in this new world sound, which is a result of fusion, and that becomes memory. That becomes the tunes that we hear. That becomes the tunes that we hear when you hear Chuck Berry, but you also hear Elvis Presley trying to do Chuck Berry. You know, you hear that kind of thing where people fuse. They fuse. Madonna trying to fuse all of these. I mean, whether you like it or not, she's trying to fuse all of these different sounds, or Bruce Springsteen or Miles Davis bringing together African sounds and European sounds. You know, this is the United States, and so there's a new music being played here. I mean, I love Beethoven and Schubert and Haydn and Mozart and all that. It's wonderful. And I love, at the same time, pure African sounds. But at the same time, I'm really interested, as a cultural thing, what happens when all of that comes together here and combines and fuses, and what you produce a new kind of form in that situation.
Okay, now this is very interesting and unusual to me, because it has been many years since I've heard anyone say to me something like that America is the melting pot. And you're talking about meldings and fusions at a time when most people are talking about how the melt doesn't mix, mm-hmm. you know, how mm-hmm. there's discontinuities in the melt. If you're talking then about sound as memory, is sound universal memory?
I think it can touch, and I think that sound can touch something deep down, primal, deep down, that we don't even know about. You know, I mean, it just touches you here. One of my friends once said that art touches the heart first, and then it goes to the brain. But most people would try to let it touch the brain first and then go mm-hmm. someplace else. So I think great music touches, and great sound touches the heart, and then it goes to the brain, you know, in a sense. And I wanted to say one other thing. I don't know if I think that it's a melting pot. I don't know if I believe that. I just believe that fusion, for me, fusion of sound and language and culture. We are Americans because we are defined by a culture of sound and linguistic, verbal gymnastics and food and all of that, dress and certain things we see. But music plays a very important part in that. And so what I'm trying to do with my work is to try to marry that, so that we can talk about an American form in poetry and in literature.
I'm talking to Quincy Troupe.
In addition to being a poet, you know, Quincy collaborated on the autobiography of Miles Davis. And I wanted to ask you about that autobiography, Quincy. It's very raw, very in your face. It refuses to make Miles Davis into a role model. It doesn't give us a politically correct Miles. You don't pretty him up. How come?
Yeah, I think that Miles Davis, that's the way he was. I mean, he was in your face. I mean, and so he wanted to preserve that. He was unreconstructed. I mean, he was that kind of person. He was that kind of person. He was not interested in all those niceties, that whole idea of manners. He wasn't interested in that. He was interested at the end of his life with preserving who he was and what he believed in and his statement. You know, that's what he was interested in. Because I said to him, I said, Miles, listen, I'm interested in this book as literature. Mm-hmm. I'm interested in this book as literature. That's the only reason I'm going to write. You're a hero of mine, but that one of the main reasons I have to tell you that I'm not interested in this book just to do a book. I'm interested in this book as literature and preserving a language of a place, of a person, an attitude, a character. You know, I want to do that. And so I said, I'm going to write you warts and all. I'm going to put everything in here. And then if you want, when I give it to you, if you want to change it, you can change it. But I, as my duty as a writer, a serious writer, I'm going to write this book, warts and all. I'm going to give it to you then. And he said, fine. And so when I gave it to him, he asked me a couple of times, do you think I ought to leave this in here like this? And I said, yes, I think so, but it's your life. And then he decided at the end not to change anything, except maybe a couple of dates that were off because he liked it. He says, well, you know, I've been honest all my life. I've tried to be. And this is really honest. This is what happened, you know. And so I'm going to leave it like this. And this is the language that I use. This is the language, you know, the MF word in there. Somebody said to me, wow, you know, it's about 333 MF words in there. I said, yeah, but I cut out 5,000. You know what I mean? I cut out 5,000. So I much admired him for leaving it like that because he knew and I knew there was going to be people who were going to be furious with that book. And I told him that.
Now, you're engaged in writing a series of memoirs. One of them is a memoir of your time with Miles Davis. Another is a memoir of your father. Mm-hmm. And I assume a more autobiographical memoir of your life. Has your experience with Miles Davis decided you on warts and all as the procedure in autobiography?
Yes.
In other words, would you misrepresent your father?
No, I wouldn't. And that was very difficult. I started to read this passage last night about my father that was not so nice. And then I said, no, I don't want to do that because I didn't have the time to put it in context, to really talk about why I wrote this thing like this. And so, but I, you know, I'm trying to write it warts and all. I'm also trying to write it warts and all about myself. You know, I'm writing this one memoir. It's about my son, who is 26 now, who's 26 today, and my father and myself, three Quincys. I don't know what the title is, but that's what I was playing with, three Quincys. And I wanted to talk about how raising my son, I saw my father in me, you know what I mean? And the stupidity that I was kind of inflicting on my son, you know, in a sense, and the same kind that he inflicted on me. But then when I noticed that I abruptly stopped it. It was like I willed myself to stop acting like that in a way. And I'd been acting like that for a while, you know. So I'm talking about that in relationship to myself, about my own problems. I think the Miles Davis book and his honesty freed me up. That's what it did. It freed me up. I said, if this man who is this famous and this important in music can do this, then I certainly can do it. I can certainly write honestly about myself. I can write honestly about my father. I can write honestly about my shortcomings and my problems. And so in that way, he impacted me again there, just to be honest. And I think that that's more interesting if you can be honest. I think the reader can trust you more if they can see your shortcomings too, and it can be illuminating to them. I think that's what it's about, illumination. It's about illumination and trying, you're talking about this us. See, I think Americans have more in common of all ethnicities and races and more in common than we realize. And then we are more similar than we are dissimilar, you know? And so I like to bring all that up in there, you know? And sometimes it's about shortcomings too.
Now tell me then, would you say that you take exception to you, that you reject the kind of political correctness that wants to create an image of experience rather than its actuality? Are you at war?
Yes. I'm at war with that. I don't think I'm against political correctness, basically. You know, I don't think that that has. I mean, you know, I understand why people use it, why they do it, but I'm not a politician. I'm an artist. See, I look at myself as an artist. I'm a writer who happens. I'm a writer who tries to be an artist in what they do. You know, I think I like Miles Davis says you can have musicians who are technicians, and then you can have musicians who are creative artists. Well, I'm a writer who attempts to be a creative artist in what I do. And so I'm against the notion of political correctness. I'm interested in the creative flow of the imagination, you know, and where that will take me, you know, where that will take me. That's the journey that I enjoy. That's why I decided to become a poet and a writer instead of a lawyer. You know what I mean? You know, I want my imagination to take me someplace. I want to be able to write out of dreams. I want to be able to dream, you know? I want to be able to dream as I'm doing this, you know? And so sometimes it's not politically correct to say certain things, you know, to characterize people in certain ways, you know? But that's the way it is.
Now, as an artist, though, would you go out of your way to say things because they are politically incorrect?
No, I'm not going out of my way to say anything. I don't think I want to go out of my way to say anything. If it is in the flow of what I'm doing, I will deal with it. But if it's not, I won't go out of my way to make some characterization of somebody. You know, like, for example, like one of the things about the thing about Jeffrey Dahmer, see, that's in the natural flow of the way I think now. Because as an African-American, when I walk in and get on elevators and sometimes white people jump back and forth because I'm a black man, the way we've been stereotyped and scapegoated in the press, you know what I mean, because they're afraid of us. Then I always try to let people understand when I'm speaking before audiences that it's been African Americans that have been lynched in this country. You know, we have been the ones that have been lynched by mobs and by policemen. And we are the ones that, you know, had this inflicted on us. Why shouldn't I be afraid of most white men? You know what I mean? Why shouldn't, when they get in an elevator, why shouldn't I think, is this guy gonna do me in? You know, is this a Jeffrey Dahmer? Is he gonna bite me on the neck? You know what I mean? So, I mean, that's within the net. I'm not going out of my way. See, I'm just trying to think of that in relationship. I think we need I think we need a real discussion on the state of this country and the state of scapegoating, the state of violence, where it is and where it actually is, you know? I mean, where it actually is, instead of trying to scapegoat people. So that's within the natural flow of what I might talk about, you know? That's natural.
Because, you know, when you started out and you have a poem in which you think about changing directions from the morbid and the dark image, the grim image, to one of, you know, comedy and the scuzz between the toes. And you come from a tradition that I love and remember very well, that I would describe as being defined by you, Ishmael Reed, and Amiri Baraka, of a kind of satiric jubilee. Mm-hmm. There's almost a joy in excavating and demonstrating the horrors of the life around. Mm-hmm. That seems to have given way now. Mm-hmm. To something else. Mm-hmm. In a lot of people's poetry, and people who haven't changed, like Ishmael Reed, for instance, seem perhaps not to be doing their very best work at this moment. Mm-hmm. What is the change? What is the reason for a new kind of projection?
Yeah, I think for me, you know, I think I told somebody one time, you know, I have meditated on death, I think, as much as anybody. You know, I mean, I've written about it, I've excavated it, I've talked about it, you know, from all kinds of angles. That poem that you're talking about, changing course, and you kind of, you know, I'm trying to do something funny. I've been writing about all this ghoulish stuff all the time, so now I'm going to try to write about something funny. Then I said, no, I think I better go back to my old ways of writing about goo, you know, and blood and gore. But now I think that, you know, that was one of the reasons I wanted to leave New York, because I was tired of doing that, because I said to myself one day, you know, I'm a relatively happy person. I have a great wife. I have a great son. You know, I have a great group of friends. you know, of all ethnicities and races and all that. I have a great life. You know, I travel. I mean, things wrong in the world with me and with the world and with the political system and all that. But it's some joy here, too. It's some other kind of stuff happening. It's some other kind of things happening that I want to explore. And I think that I should be able to explore those. And I will explore those areas. I will explore that. I will write about cacophony. I will write about language being cacophonous. I will write musical language. But I'll also explore farms. I will also try to create farms like Terracinas. And I will also write in Sestinas. I will also write in Villanelles. Because I'm an American writer, see? And I think for this book, they fit in this book, Avalanche, that I'm doing. They fit, and so I'm going to do that because I think that I will bring to bear all of the technical skill, all of the vision, all of the imagination that I have to do something, you know? And I think that that's important. I think it's important to change course sometimes. I think it's important to change course for yourself. After all, we write for ourselves. I mean, I'm not John Grisham. You know, I'm not John Grisham. You know, I'm not trying to do that. I'm not trying to write a blockbuster all the time or trying to in the next movie deal and all that. I'm not thinking about it. I'm trying to think about the art, the form of it. You know, I'm trying to preserve something. I'm trying to leave something that will be lasting in a sense, if I can. I mean, that's the goal. That's for me, that's the desire, you know, to do that. Whether you do it or you don't, time will tell. You know, history will tell that, you know, but that's what I would like to do. In a sense. So I think sometimes you need to change. And in that sense, Miles Davis for me becomes a model, see, because he kept changing. He kept doing that, you know, and sometimes people didn't like that he changed, but he kept doing it, you know, and I think that's courageous. And, you know, and I would like to be able to leave something like that.
I've been speaking to Quincy Troop on the subject of imaging the us, an exploration of autobiographical writings, which has been being done as a series in collaboration with the Getty Center. Thank you for joining me, Quincy Troop.
Thank you, Michael.
My associate producer is Melinda Siegel. The engineer today is Scott Fritz. Special thanks to Roberto Bedoya of the Getty Center. I'm Michael Silverblatt. Join me again next week on Bookworm.
To the jungles you can go in books. To the land of ice and snow in books.
As you ramble through the pages, books will take you through the ages. Back to days of old when knights were bold in books.
Books, 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 books. Books. Books can be funny too.
Books make you laugh and sing. Books tell you everything. They're your treasured friends in prose and rhyme.
Now it's book of the mouse pop time.
Funds for Bookworm are provided in part by Lannan Foundation.
I want to tell you about a new show from the Financial Times called Life and Art from FT Weekend, hosted by me, Lila Raptopoulos. Life and Art is twice a week. On Mondays, I have a guest on to talk about life and how to live a good one. Everything from winter travel to cooking to living more creatively. And on Fridays, we talk art. Two FT journalists and I discuss a piece of culture that's in the air. New music, movies, and more. Find Life and Art from FT Weekend wherever you listen.